Nuclear promises, nuclear lies. How far back do they go? For an industry that was birthed in wartime secrecy during the Manhattan Project, after the horror that met the bombing of Japan, it needed to establish a rationale for continuing to exist. So how about making up something called Atoms for Peace and the promise of an unlimited supply of electricity generated by nuclear energy, a supply that was promised to be too cheap to meter? Nuclear reactors as the Santa Claus of energy. Huzzah! But really, there ain't no such thing as a free lunch, especially when it comes to nuclear. So here we are, decades later, and you listen closely when a respected leader and member of some of the most prestigious organizations that oppose the nuclear enterprise tells you,
"I would suggest that that very statement of too cheap to meter was a bald-faced lie from the get-go. And it's my argument that what the government has done has given us all these sales pitches. It's too cheap to meter. It's clean. It can solve climate change. None of those arguments are at all true. They're just meant to sound good to the public and to gain public acceptance and support for the nuclear enterprise."
And that's exactly what they've been accomplishing. Public acceptance of the nuclear enterprise. And that's what we're fighting against, though not as effectively as we might. So when you hear Alfred Meyer, a longtime member and executive of Physicians for Social Responsibility and many other nuclear groups, explain why our talking points aren't working, and then he comes up with suggestions of how we need to be framing our arguments against nukes in a way that links the energy and weapons arguments, you begin to recognize how you and I and everyone have been manipulated into wasting time and energy making great arguments against the wrong targets and allowing the continuation of our time in that awful, devastating seat that we all share.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things nuclear from a different perspective. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when those nuclear so-called experts get it wrong. This week, an amazingly illuminating interview with Alfred Meyer, a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, who has worked to found, lead, and support numerous other organizations that oppose nuclear. His insights are solid, grounded, and as a result of this interview, I've already shifted many of my talking points as regards the connections between nuclear energy and nuclear war. This is a real eye-opener. So stay tuned. We'll also have a short interview I've been wanting to share for a while. It's with Dr. Gordon Edwards of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He offers fresh insights into radioactive waste and some of its sources that you may not have considered, as well as why small modular nuclear reactors, which have not yet been built, so they don't exist, but how they will come with an unexpectedly enormous cost to ratepayers. There will also be some brief excerpts from my Halloween show, where I asked activists from around the world what scares them most about nuclear. Today is Tuesday, June 4, 2024, and here is this week's nuclear news from a different perspective. It's an all-interview show this week, so here is the first featured interview. Sometimes when I reach out for an interview, it's with someone whose work I've not known, but I've caught something that they said or wrote and gotten the impulse to learn more. Often I'm rewarded with a different perspective of information that opens my eyes and shifts my focus to something deeper, richer, and more compelling, which is what happened as a result of this week's guest. I was on a Zoom meeting with Joseph Mangano of Radiation and Public Health when during a Q&A, I first heard today's guest, Alfred Meyer. He packed so much information and insight into just 2 minutes that I knew I had to get him on the show. Then I read his October 2022 article in The Progressive, It's All About the Bomb, Why Civilian Nuclear Power is Merely a Cover for Producing More Nuclear Weapons. As a piece of writing, it's a knockout. Alfred Meyer is a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, PSR, and has served variously as Executive Director of PSR Wisconsin, Board Member of PSR National, and President of PSR New York. He also co-authored a PSR IPPNW, International Physicians for the Prevention of Nuclear War, critique of the United Nations Scientific Committee on the Effects of Nuclear Radiation report that purportedly reported on the health effects of the radioactive releases from the damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear reactors in Japan. Alfred has also founded, co-founded, and or served as an executive for half a dozen other major organizations dedicated to nuclear issues relating to Fukushima, Chernobyl, Ukraine, and the connection between proposed fusion weapons with nuclear reactor infrastructure. His insights into languaging and framing our arguments against nuclear are seismic, and you deserve to not only listen, but take notes, take his suggestions to heart, and use them wherever you can. I spoke with Alfred Meyer on December 23rd, 2022. Alfred Meyer, thanks so much for joining us here on Nuclear Hot Seat.
It's my pleasure.
Give people a sense of your background and what has been your involvement with nuclear groups and issues.
I've been a longtime member of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I've fulfilled several different roles with the organization. For a number of years, I was the executive director of the Wisconsin chapter. I then moved to Washington, D.C., where I became joined the national board of PSR. I served on that board for 12 years. Now I'm living in New York City, and so I'm involved with the New York City chapter.
You recently published an article in The Progressive called It's All About the Bomb, with the subtitle, Why Civilian Nuclear Power is Merely a Cover for Producing More Nuclear Weapons. And I'd like to go through some of the points that you made here on a step-by-step basis, because it was a real eye-opener for me.
Well, I'm glad it did make you think differently about this, because I fear that we've been hoodwinked by a fairly successful public relations campaign over many decades.
I would call it a propaganda campaign, but we'll get to that.
Yeah.
Let's start at the beginning, when the United Nations seems to have played a central, if indecisive, role in international positioning on atomic and nuclear issues. What were their early efforts, starting in 1945, to control this technology?
I'm not able to answer that in any detail. I know that in a general sense that there were various groups who wanted to either abolish or control nuclear activities, and that the world was absolutely horrified by the United States' use of nuclear bombs in World War II. And I note in my article that when we firebombed Tokyo, burning 100,000 people and dislocating over a million people, that didn't seem to be a huge problem. But when we used the two atomic weapons on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, that occasioned huge outcry against this new kind of weapon and a new kind of horror. There was a big pushback against the whole nuclear enterprise.
It seems that one of the stumbling blocks, which you mention in this article, is the fact that the United Nations gave special status to countries that were recognized as possessing nuclear weapons. We're talking about the Security Council, all five members of which are nuclear countries. They all have ultimate veto power, and that made it impossible, really, for the United Nations to take any strong stand against nukes. Would that be accurate?
Yes, I don't actually know what year the Security Council made the five nuclear powers permanent members, but you're absolutely right that the Security Council, they have veto power over what the Security Council does. I'm very pleased to report that the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, TPNW, one of the genius parts of that is that the organizers went to the General Assembly, where there was not the veto power by the weapons-holding countries, and there was vast concurrence that this is an unacceptable threat to life on Earth. And that's why that treaty has been passed, and many countries are ratifying it. And so that has been a very wonderful counterbalance. I'm very sorry to say that I do feel that the United Nations is, generally speaking, pro-nuclear. Well, the IAEA, the International Atomic Energy Agency, which does do some very fine and important work, but if you go look at their mission statement, it is stated in just so many words that their mission is to promote nuclear technology. Promote nuclear technology. And I think that's a very unfortunate thing. And the United States was instrumental in founding the IAEA at the UN. And that its initial leaders were from the U.S., which ensured that the U.S. interests were safeguarded.
Let's take this in somewhat chronological order. Starting back in 1945 and going through to the early 50s, how did nuclear weapons, which of course had an automatic pushback by people around the world, by governments around the world, how did nuclear weapons evolve into this acceptance and promotion of nuclear power reactors, nuclear energy?
At the end of World War II, the notion was promoted that we won that war because we used atomic weapons, that atomic weapons are the magic super weapon. It's what we feared Germany would get and therefore be able to dominate the world. But we got them, and we feel militarily that this was our ultimate trump card, our strongest suit. And so even though the public opinion in the world was very, very much against nuclear weapons, the military was very, very much for nuclear weapons. And I allude to the problem that President Eisenhower had when he came into office in 1953, because he had his military folks pushing for more atomic weapons, but public opinion was so strongly against it. It's a curious little story that in August of 1953, the Russians exploded a highly sophisticated hydrogen bomb. Now, we knew that they had a weapons program, but Eisenhower was terrifically worried because this was such a sophisticated weapon. And he actually considered having a kind of fireside chat, which I characterize as maybe a mushroom cloud chat, with the American people in 1953 to explain to us that this is a terrible risk to the survival of humans on Earth. You know, he was deeply shaken by this. But by December of that year, 1953, he was before the General Assembly at the United Nations in New York, giving his Atoms for Peace speech. And in that, he is trying to promise this untold benefit. We'll solve world hunger. It's going to improve medicine. It's just going to be the greatest thing since sliced bread. And that was his sales pitch, to repackage the horror of atomic weapons and instead sell this other product, which is untold benefit for peaceful mankind.
Even the title Atoms for Peace was a rebranding of nuclear, even when we weren't using that particular technology. And it was based on having nuclear reactors provide power. And the phrase they used was that the power produced would be, quote unquote, too cheap to meter. They're always saying that it's going to be financially viable and, as you said, a benefit. Where did Atoms for Peace go wrong? Or was it wrong from the beginning?
You mentioned the quip by Louis Strauss, who was head of the Atomic Energy Commission, that nuclear power would give us energy, quote, too cheap to meter. He had in his possession at the time he made that public statement a government-sponsored report on the feasibility of nuclear power. It identified the biggest problem with nuclear power as being cost. So I would suggest that that very statement of too cheap to meter was a bald-faced lie from the get-go. And it's my argument that what the government has done is has given us all these sales pitches. It's too cheap to meter. It's clean. It can solve climate change. None of those arguments are at all true. They're just meant to sound good to the public and to gain public acceptance and support for the nuclear enterprise.
One of the problems that you point out repeatedly in the article and that is well known is that in the waste stream from a nuclear reactor, those quote unquote spent fuel rods aren't really spent at all because they contain plutonium. And the plutonium, with just a few steps, can be made weapons grade. So in essence, any country that has a nuclear reactor has the potential for creating a nuclear weapon. And indeed, that is how both India and Pakistan got their nuclear weapons.
They had Canadian CANDU reactors.
They got theirs from Canada, but it was the same concept of we're sharing the technology because this is a good thing for you.
Sharing the peaceful technology. Now, the fact is that the vast majority of all the vast inputs needed for nuclear weapons, what's needed for nuclear power is just about the same thing as nuclear weapons. Obviously, designing a weapon is different than just operating a reactor, but it maintains the same infrastructure, vast infrastructure. The Manhattan Project, which was developed in secret in 1942, constructed an industrial base in this country that was the same size as the automobile industry was at that time. And I think we all have an understanding when we get in a car and you start thinking, well, what does it take to make a car? Well, you've got the sheet metal, you've got the glass, you have all different kinds of glass, you have the radio knobs and the door knobs and the steering, you know, just so many parts and inputs and special materials. And the nuclear enterprise is the same way. It's a vast, broad, industrial, academic, military, and governmental infrastructure. And by pushing Atoms for Peace, we helped develop that infrastructure in this country in the early 50s.
And of course, with the infrastructure that was developed in the 1940s to actually build the first bombs, we had so much of it in Oak Ridge, at Hanford in Washington State, and at Los Alamos, that the government did not want to back away from that and say, okay, we're going to make all this garbage now. They went, what can we do with it? And it's been brought to my awareness that one of the drivers behind the push for Atoms for Peace was the ability of the government, which until then was tasked with coming up with its own plutonium and having reactors to create it and all of the expense with that, was able to fob off the reactors to create plutonium on private enterprise, on private investment. And that allowed them to alleviate that particular cost.
The creation of the civilian nuclear power industry in the early 1950s served several ends. Number one, it essentially spun off this very large, essential part of the weapons industry and again repackaged it as peaceful civilian industry. Now, I am not saying that they're making nuclear weapons at your local nuclear reactor. But I am saying that the infrastructure needed for nuclear reactor power generation supports and builds the infrastructure needed for making nuclear weapons. Part of this, too, was, if you recall, the Manhattan Project was entirely a governmental organization. And there are some in our political spectrum who feel that Franklin Delano Roosevelt was almost a socialist. Certainly, it was too much government influence. So not only were they spinning off this huge part of the weapons endeavor, they were giving it to capitalism, private enterprise. And so this was to counterbalance what had been such a governmentally oriented effort previously. but it has never had to be self-supporting. It's not cheap. It doesn't make money. You mentioned the Price-Anderson Act. If it's so safe, why aren't there commercial insurers scrambling to insure it? Well, it's because it's not so safe. It's too big a risk.
Insurance companies will not touch it on any level, either to insure the facilities themselves or to insure homeowners for Correct. Any damage that is done because of a radiation release or a nuclear anything. And I challenge anyone who's a homeowner who is listening to this discussion to go to their homeowner's insurance policy and look under exclusions, and they will see that there is always, always in the boilerplate, a specific exclusion for being able to make claims for any damage that happens because of a nuclear incident.
Yes. So you look at the nuclear industry, you have government loan guarantees, which basically say, if you borrow money to build a reactor and it doesn't work out, we will cover the shortfall. Then you have the government paying for the operating liability insurance, which for such a dangerous endeavor is a huge cost. And then the government's taking the waste at the end of it. I mean, what other industry, I ask you, has this special treatment? And you'd think that with all those benefits, they'd be making money hand over fist, which many of the companies are. But there still is ongoing massive subsidies for nuclear operations. And my argument is that that's all justified because the real purpose is the weapons and the nuclear navy. It's not cheap power. It's not clean power. It's not solving climate change. Now, that's what it's sold to us as, but that's not what's driving the bus here.
You made a comment on a conference call that we were all on with Radiation and Public Health, Joe Mangano's group. And that was what got my ears pricked up to talk with you here, because you were saying that in terms of activists and the argument against nuclear for climate change, that argument has been made repeatedly and well, but nobody's paying attention to it. So it's like we're hitting a bullseye, but we're aiming at the wrong target. Explain that.
Yes, I'd say there's a sham target. The real target is nuclear weapons and the nuclear navy. But I want to be very clear for your listeners that the critiques of nuclear power, be it on the basis of cost, environmental degradation, safety, and the totally unsolved and huge problem of nuclear waste and pollution, those are all valid, important, critical arguments. What got me started on this whole line of thinking was I read one more wonderfully done, thoroughly researched, expertly presented argument against nuclear power, and I observed that that's not changing the trajectory of the enterprise. We're absolutely right. I mean, in 2006, Bryce Smith wrote a book called Insurmountable Risks, in which he basically said, how can nuclear power solve climate change? Let's just for the argument's sake, remove all these pesky environmentalists and anti-nuke folks. Let's just tell the industry, go solve climate change with nuclear power. And it's impossible for them to do it, even without any impediments. They'd have to be opening up a new reactor every week and a new geological waste repository every year. We can't even do that over decades. And the new reactors being built are, as has always been the case, terrifically behind schedule and way over budget.
I'd like to jump in on that because I recently read a rundown of the new nuclear reactors that said that at this time, the small modular, and they call them SMR, small modular reactors. They take the N word out, nuclear. I call them small modular nuclear reactors. The number that are currently being built, zero. The number of designs approved, zero. The fact that the only place they can get the special fuel that they need, which is this high-powered fuel, it's called HALEU, it's high-assay, low-enrichment uranium. The only place that it is manufactured is in Russia.
Correct.
And that might be at least one of the factors underlying why there are no sanctions against anything in the nuclear industry as regards Russia since the war on Ukraine.
Yes. What I could say about small modular nuclear reactors is that their true purpose, as noted in the 2018 World Nuclear Industry Status Report, their real purpose is for submarine and naval propulsion units. They're not for Topeka, Kansas. But there's been a massive program. Every town and village is talking about, well, gosh, we might have an SMR here. Well, I don't think they will appear. And you're totally right. They're what we call PowerPoint reactors. They exist only on paper. But their purpose is the nuclear Navy. You mentioned HALEU fuel, high assay, low enriched uranium fuel. High enrichment is considered to be 20% U-235. HALEU fuel is enriched to 19.8%. So it's right up to the cutoff point. And to get from the 0.7% enrichment of natural ore to 19.8% enrichment is the lion's share of the work to getting to weapons grade. So again, the HALEU fuel, I am arguing its true purpose. It's not for the SMR down the road. It's for weapons production. And you also are very correct that there's a big push in the United States government to create the entire uranium fuel chain within our country. And HALEU fuel will be part of this. Senator Manchin just introduced a bill, 4064, the International Nuclear Energy Act of 2022. This bill would create a whole-of-government enterprise to promote United States exports of nuclear energy infrastructure to countries around the world.
And this goes to a point that has been coming clear to me about how the proliferation and the promotion of nuclear reactors and nuclear technology on the ground is really a Cold War expansion and a gathering together of allies, not necessarily willing allies, but ultimate and forever allies. Because once you're tied in with the nuclear infrastructure of a country, be it the United States or Russia, once you are tied in, you cannot separate yourself. It's like for a reactor, parts are not interchangeable between different systems. There's no such thing as an auto zone for nuclear. There's no nuclear zone. You have materials and parts that cannot be swapped out with each other. So once you have gotten in bed with whoever your supplier is, that's where you're stuck. And it's forever because they're in charge of the parts, the technology, the training of the people who are responsible for the infrastructure. And then you've got the problem of the waste, which nobody has solved yet, except dumping it around indigenous people or third world people or someplace where the white male majority is not. So the proliferation and the promotion of this technology by these different countries is really an ultimate Cold War leading to a kind of nuclear slavery, that any country that gets in bed with one of the big powers saying, oh, we'll give you nukes, it might be attractive on the front end, but on the back end, there's no out. You will never get out of it.
Yes, and this is a strategy of a kind of technological domination as a military strategy. The F-35 fighter plane illustrates this very much. Its supply chain within this country is in 48 of the 50 states. And we are selling it to 12 of our allies, and we're manufacturing parts of it in many other foreign countries. You know, Germany just last week decided to buy this F-35, which technologically speaking has been a very flawed product. But it's the big deal in air forces. And once you buy it, yes, you are bound to the United States.
So turning this to an activist perspective, you said quite pointedly that we've hit the bullseye, but we're aiming at the wrong target. That's a great way to put it. What would you suggest we make our target? And how would you suggest that we start prioritizing our arguments and working on our talking points?
Well, I think that what we need to do, there's characteristically been a bifurcation of the nuclear movement and nuclear attitudes. People say, oh, I work on nuclear power. Oh, I work on nuclear weapons. And I think we have to blend those two groups together, and both groups work on both aspects. And again, I repeat that the arguments against nuclear power are cogent, they're important, and they're real. And so I think that what we need to do is expand our horizon. So we're really saying we need to move away from nuclear weapons and nuclear navies. And one of the reasons is because of the cost. And then you can point to all the costs of reactors, or it's the environmental degradation. You can point to, you know, every step of the fuel chain, from the mining of uranium to milling and enrichment and fuel fabrication, to the regular releases from nuclear power reactors. You know, all these things are very important items, but I think we need to put it in the context of what it's really supporting, which is the nuclear weapons and the nuclear navy.
Is that a project that has come before Physicians for Social Responsibility that you know? Do you know of any groups that are specifically working on coordinating our talking points so that we focus on that and perhaps become more effective in our messaging?
I do not know of any groups currently who are trying to take this approach of taking this perspective that I argue in my piece in The Progressive that says it's all about the bomb. And so this discussion is just starting. I'm hoping that the publication of my article, I'm hoping this podcast will spur people to have further discussion. I would love to discuss this with other people to develop strategies, but it's kind of in the formative stages of this. But I got started on this, Libby, because I read yet one more expert article critiquing nuclear power, but it doesn't do anything. And so that's why I think we need to have our target be what the real driving force of this nuclear enterprise.
Well, I have to say that if you're dealing with languaging or messaging, count me in on that discussion and that strategizing. I will be open to anyone who contacts me to put them in contact with you and see what we might do to get a group together, at least a Zoom call, sometime early in 2023. And I invite you to come back on the show as this progresses and give us updates as to what our messaging can be and how we can be more effective in the steps we take and the energy we exert in trying to put an end to nuclear weapons and nuclear energy.
Yes, and if I could add on a comment about the fusion experiment, which a couple of weeks ago was successful. And again, I mean, because this illustrates the argument I'm making. I'm sure that your listeners saw articles about, you know, we're going to have clean power that doesn't even make nuclear waste now. Well, no, we won't. The real purpose of that experiment was to confirm the validity of the computer programs used to design nuclear weapons, because we no longer test nuclear weapons in the real world. So it's all based on computer programs. And that experiment was a critical part of proving that those computer programs are correct. But so that's for weapons. But you didn't see any news coverage about, well, maybe we'll develop a fusion weapon. And this is why it would be such a good battlefield tool. No, you heard this pablum, this false narrative about, well, we're going to have clean power now. I don't think it'll happen in the lifetime of my grandchildren. Of course, I hope that all of us can change the trajectory of the nuclear enterprise well before that.
Alfred, listening to you first on the conference call with Radiation and Public Health Project opened my ears. You have now progressively, between the article and this conversation, continued to open my eyes, and I will do my best to carry that message forward on Nuclear Hot Seat.
I just welcome your involvement and that of others. This needs to be a collaborative and networking effort. There are many good groups like Back from the Brink, which work to end the nuclear weapons threat. But I think we need to get them on board to say that, in my mind, if we are going after both the weapons and the reactors which enable them, we stand a good chance of success. And as I note in my article, civilian nuclear power, and this is a quote from ex-U.S. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz, he said that civilian nuclear power is an essential enabler of our national security, which I define as nuclear weapons, the nuclear navy. And the very downtown think tank in Washington, D.C., the Atlantic Council, it has calculated this contribution of civilian nuclear power to our national security at $42.4 billion per year. So this, again, is how, by spinning off civilian nuclear power, we don't have to ask for that much money for the weapons program, because it's not weapons, right? Well, correct, they're not making weapons at the reactor sites, but if we didn't have them, it wouldn't be, we wouldn't have the nuclear weapons capacity. For every reactor, power reactor we have on land in the U.S., which is about 100, there are almost 100 naval reactors at sea. So it's by having a big civilian nuclear power effort, we are enabling the nuclear weapons side of things. And a big challenge for the industry, too, is attracting bright young science students into this field. And I think that's one reason why SMRs are so highly touted and presented as they're coming to every neighborhood near you, because that gives people the idea that, well, this is a cutting edge industry. I think I better get on with it, as opposed to the more accurate viewpoint, again pointed out by the World Nuclear Industry Status Report, that the nuclear power industry has been in decline since the year 2002. For the past 20 years, this industry has been contracting. And that's a huge challenge for the industry. And this is why they need such a deceptive sales pitch that makes us think that this is going to be great for all of us.
So the work of those who oppose nuclear is about taking that vulnerability and turning it into our talking points and making that where we push, so that we're putting the crowbar under the right piece of information and getting that out into the world. And we need to do that in a coordinated way, in an echo chamber kind of a way. The nuclear industry has its own, because my God, when that fusion announcement happened, it wasn't some little press release. They had this pre-planned across the board. I don't remember ever seeing such a blatant full court press, everything from government and press conference and TV news, all the way through Dan Rather and Stephen Colbert doing 7 minutes of it on his show. And then they back away from it because the point's been made, the thought has been surgically implanted in people's minds, and nuclear industry doesn't have to do anything else because we're swimming upstream to try and get that taken out. They've already implanted it. So there are lots of challenges for those of us who wish to support accurate messaging about nuclear and its dangers and where it's connected and why we need to get rid of it in a way that people can understand.
And I think another thing from a strategy standpoint to consider is that to possess the nuclear enterprise, to possess nuclear weapons, for instance, in the best case scenario, even if there are no accidents, no problems, you know, if everything went perfectly, it still harms the population that possesses the weapons, that we are contaminating our biosphere. You know, even if we don't and never use one of these weapons, just to have them in our arsenal is very damaging to us. And we, in fact, as a world, are involved in a unplanned, out-of-control, non-consensual human experiment of irradiating the biosphere. And we know not what this will do. And there's, you know, discussion of Japan dumping all this, they call it tritiated water, back into the ocean. But the report I just, or discussion I just heard recently, is that in fact, they don't know what's in those tanks. Yes, there's tritium, but there are about 60 other things there too, and they have not characterized what it is. They don't know how much. So how in the world can they say, oh, it's safe to do? They don't know what they're doing. But from a business standpoint, sure, a lot better to dump it in the sea than to pay for taking care of it. So we're up against a huge military industrial forces. But I always maintain the only reason you and I are able to have this conversation today is that there are more good people than bad, and we need to rally together and succeed in this effort.
I couldn't have put it better. Alfred Meyer, this has been a greatly illuminating conversation. I look forward to having many more with you in 2023 and beyond. And I want to thank you for being my guest this week on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
That was Alfred Meyer, longtime Physicians for Social Responsibility member and leader. We'll have a link up to his article from The Progressive. It's all about the bomb, why civilian nuclear power is merely a cover for producing more nuclear weapons. It will be on our website, nuclearhotseat.com, under this episode, number 676. And while you're there, look for the yellow opt-in box. You really can't miss it. And if you haven't already done so, sign up to get one email a week from Nuclear Hot Seat that will contain a link to that week's episode and a brief summary of some other material in the show. We will continue with this week's featured interviews in just a moment. But first, follow the money. That's what the nuclear industry does, never letting up with their propaganda, talking points, op-eds, talk show bookers, and other tactics to brainwash our politicians, reporters, and the public into giving them whatever they want, which is money, money, and, oh, by the way, more money. And let's face it, they already have plenty to fund their PR hacks and their agenda. It's a business model with a terrific return on investment, because whatever millions the nukesters spend on their public relations propaganda, they stand to get billions of dollars back from bailouts, subsidies, tax breaks, and hapless taxpayers and ratepayers who provide the money whether we want to or not. That awareness is why you need Nuclear Hot Seat. For 13 full years now, Nuclear Hot Seat has empowered listeners every week with a one-hour hit of honest nuclear information. We provide in-depth interviews with genuine experts, a roundup of international news, numbnuts of the week for outstanding nuclear boneheadedness, and even occasional outbursts of musical theater. Where else can you find all this in a weekly counterbalance to the nuclear industry lies? But in order to go up against them, this show operates on a bake sale budget, and that budget is entirely dependent on you, the listeners. So help keep us going with a donation of any size. Just toddle on down to nuclearhotseat.com, click on the big red donate button, and help us with a one-time donation or set up a recurring donation of as little as $5 a month. We are a 501c3 nonprofit organization, which means that your donation is tax deductible. So go to nuclearhotseat.com, click on that red donate button, follow the prompts, or send it directly to us via Zelle to info@nuclearhotseat.com. Whatever you can do to help, I'm deeply grateful that you're listening and that you care. Now we continue with this week's second featured interview. Dr. Gordon Edwards is a mathematician, physicist, nuclear consultant, as well as president and co-founder of the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility. He has served as a consultant on nuclear issues for governmental and non-governmental bodies for over 45 years and been accepted as an expert witness by U.S. and Canadian courts and tribunals. He is frequently invited to testify before provincial and federal bodies and to give major addresses in various countries. He also knows how to explain complex nuclear matters in a way that is easy to understand, for which I am eternally grateful. When I interviewed Dr. Edwards for Nuclear Hot Seat number 661 last February 20th, he provided such a wealth of information that our talk ran long, and I had to lift out a portion of it at that time. I've wanted to share it ever since. This deals with sources of radiation from nuclear reactors that we haven't necessarily considered, and the inflated expenses for small modular nuclear reactors, should they ever be built. I spoke with Dr. Edwards on February 12, 2024.
Many people don't realize that when they think about radioactive waste, they think of the irradiated fuel, which of course is the most radioactive and the most long-lived of all the radioactive waste coming out of a reactor. However, people don't realize how radioactive the structures themselves become. So even after you remove the fuel, the actual structures in the core of the reactor are highly radioactive as well, and will remain radioactive for tens of thousands of years. And that's because ordinary non-radioactive materials, when exposed to neutrons, which are flying around inside the reactor core, become radioactive. So neutron acts like a magic wand that transforms a non-radioactive material into a radioactive one. For example, this is how ordinary hydrogen becomes tritium, radioactive hydrogen. This is how ordinary carbon becomes carbon-14, radioactive carbon. And there are impurities in the steel, which are like cobalt-59, which is not radioactive, and it gets transformed into cobalt-60, which is intensely radioactive. So all the structures become radioactive simply by being there and being exposed to the neutrons. Now, in small modular reactors, they're much smaller. Consequently, they're much closer to the source of neutrons, and therefore much more waste is produced. So between 5 and 30 times more waste per unit of energy is produced in the structures by the impingement of these neutrons. And so the waste becomes, not only the high-level waste becomes much more radioactive than normal high-level waste, but even the structure itself becomes more radioactive than normal, than happens in most nuclear reactors. Now, here's the big problem. Where does that waste go? Oftentimes they say, well, they're going to look after the high-level waste, but what about all the structural waste? That's called the decommissioning waste. And what we have in Canada, again, the same consortium that is planning this mega dump that we just talked about, that same consortium is also planning to decommission two rather small nuclear reactors by simply burying them right beside the river where they were built. And not to take them away, not to dismantle them and take them away, but simply to dig a hole and bury the stuff and pour concrete over it so that now it's all fixed, it's all safe for the next 10,000 years or 20,000 years, 100,000 years. So the danger is that with small modular reactors, since they have not enunciated what their plan is for these reactors, it's quite likely that they're going to want to just bury them where they are. That means that everywhere they build a small modular reactor will also become a permanent radioactive waste dump for many thousands of years into the future. So we will have not just dozens or even hundreds, but we will have thousands of radioactive waste sites all over the country.
That's if they get their way.
If they get their way. And the one thing that's on our side there is the invisible fist of Adam Smith. Because, in fact, these things are so expensive, they're going to price themselves right out of the market, just as the larger reactors have done. In fact, the reason they built larger reactors in the first place was to make them more affordable. So when they build the smaller ones, they're going to be more expensive than the larger ones per unit of energy. And they're hoping that they can mass produce them in such a way that they turn them out like refrigerators, and this will somehow magically reduce the cost down to an affordable level. But in fact, that's a pipe dream, because there are so many competing models that it's almost impossible for any one model to have enough market share to make it affordable to mass produce them. So this whole plan of small modular reactors is really like a slow motion train wreck. It's not going to actually succeed. It cannot succeed. It's going to bankrupt anybody who tries to follow that path. We already know that renewables are much cheap, 4 to 5 times cheaper per unit of energy, and getting cheaper all the time, whereas nuclear is getting more expensive all the time. And so they've already parted company. Renewables are already far cheaper than nuclear. And in fact, the International Energy Agency predicts that in the next 5 years, worldwide, 90% of all new electricity generating facilities will be renewable.
Mark Jacobson just posted that last weekend we hit, for the first time, California generated 117% of its energy needs, meaning more than its full energy needs, using renewables only, without counting nuclear at all. First time that's happened, but it won't be the last.
Yeah, and that's also happened in other countries as well. Germany has also achieved that same standard. So I think that this is obviously the way to go. And what we have here is a situation of nuclear opportunism, because the nuclear industry has been stagnant for the last 25 years. There have been basically, it's been a plateau for the last 25 years worldwide. And from over the last quarter of century, there's only been a net increase of four reactors. There were 400 and some reactors in 1979, and then now there's just four more reactors than that. So it's already on a steep decline. It's gone down. The share of nuclear electricity in the global market has gone down from 17% of the total electricity share down to less than 10%. And by the way, since electricity is only one slice of the energy pie, so if you look at that 20% slice, actually 17% of that slice really represents only 3% of world energy. And so it's gone down, nuclear has gone down from 3% to less than 2% in the last 25 years. This is not the sign of success. So what's happening with the small modular reactors is that the nuclear industry, which is badly hurting, has said, look, there's going to be trillions of dollars on the table to fight climate change. We should grab as much of that money as we can. And what this is a huge money grab. And nuclear power and the small modular reactors, more than anything else, they represent a dirty, dangerous distraction from actually an effective strategy to fight climate change.
Dr. Gordon Edwards. We will have a link up to the Canadian Coalition for Nuclear Responsibility website, ccnr.org, on our website, Nuclear Hot Seat, number 676. And if you want to put this piece in context with the rest of the interview that we did, you can find that at Nuclear Hot Seat number 661 from February 20th, 2024. For our final feature, as you hear this, I will be out of town in the middle of my annual off-grid vacation, where I detach from what passes as civilization and reconnect with nature. Let's just say that the ocean is looking pretty good to me. To conclude this program, I'm incorporating excerpts from a feature I did last Halloween, where I asked activists from around the world what scared them most about nuclear. Here's what just a few of them had to say.
My name is Jan Boudar. I am a board member of the Nuclear Energy Information Service in Chicago. What scares me the most about nuclear is that some people believe nuclear power plants are a foil for climate change. Climate change is the victor over power plants. If the rivers become too warm or dry, they have to be shut down. If there's too much rain, they are in danger of flooding. Tornado and hurricane winds can disrupt their safety devices. Nuclear power plants are victims of climate change, not a solution to climate change. Real climate solutions are not radioactive.
My name's Kevin Hester. I'm a New Zealand Irishman and have the best and the worst of both of those traits. I've been in the anti-nuclear movement for 4.5 decades now. The thing that weighs heaviest on my mind is the possibility of having a spent fuel pool fire at one of the nuclear power stations. For anyone who doesn't know what a spent fuel pool is, it's when the fuel units have been removed from the reactor, they put them into these pools full of water to keep them cool, and they have to keep them cool for years and years and years. And when we had the disaster in Fukushima Daiichi, what is it, 12 years ago now, since then, those plants have been barely maintained, because in some of them you can't even get to some of those areas. And then, of course, we've got abrupt climate change barreling down the tracks at us at full speed. So I think it's only a matter of time before we see a spent fuel pool fire. And this planet has never, ever seen anything remotely like the existential threat that would pose to us.
Hi, my name is Leona Morgan with HallKnow, hallknow.com. And the thing that scares me most about nuclear is what it does to our non-human relatives and our future generations.
I'm Michael Ketterer. I'm a chemist and I'm professor emeritus of chemistry and biochemistry at Northern Arizona University. What really scares me the most about the entire nuclear industry complex is our impending loss of societal memory of what we have done. What scares me is that future generations will live in a world where all of the things that we know about as serious contamination or threats are long forgotten. You know, will we know about the San Onofre canisters in 1,000 years? So that's what keeps me awake at night.
Hi, my name is Brian Morrison. I'm a space scientist for the last 40 years. My biggest fear about nuclear radiation is it leaking into the ground and leaking into our food chain. That's my number one concern, what I'm really afraid of.
And of course, there are many more reasons to be afraid of nuclear and many more opinions that were expressed. If you'd like to hear more, go to the 2023 Halloween show, Nuclear Hot Seat number 655 from October 31st, 2023. And we will have another edition of this feature being prepared for Nuclear Hot Seat Halloween this year, but you have to wait until the end of October before you get a chance to hear that one. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Tuesday, June 4th, 2024. If you'd like to get Nuclear Hot Seat delivered via email every week, we make it easy. You can sign up for it by going to nuclearhotseat.com. You really can't miss that y'all opt-in box because, bam, there it is right in front of you. So if you haven't already, put in your first name and an email address, and every week we will send you one, just one email, with the link to that week's show and a short description of the show's content. That way you need never miss a single episode. Now, we're always looking for more ideas. So if you've got a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. And remember, if you can go to Nuclear Hot Seat and donate, we really need your help. Anything at all, we will appreciate your support. This episode of Nuclear Hot Seat is copyright 2024, Libby Halevi, Hartestry Communications, and Nuclear Hot Seat. All rights reserved, but fair use is allowed. In order to do so, you must cite the program, the website, and the names of anyone whose comments you use, be it the guests or me. For now, this is Libby Halevi of Nuclear Hot Seat, reminding you that the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act, or RECA, will expire on June 7, this Friday, if we don't force House Speaker Mike Johnson to introduce the bill in the form in which it passed the Senate already to the House floor. You can learn details about what RECA is, what it does, and what this battle is all about by listening to last week's show, Nuclear Hot Seat number 675. For now, call Mike Johnson's office, put it on auto dial, and call repeatedly, and tell him to bring the bill to a vote. We've got the votes on the floor, it's passed the Senate, and President Biden said he will sign. Mike Johnson is the obstruction. Let's move him. There you've got it. You have just had your weekly nuclear wake-up call. So whatever you do, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.